Hello and welcome to the First Take Film Club. I'm your host, Connor Norcott, and today I'm joined by my good pal, Liam Jones. Liam, how are you, mate?
I'm very good, mate. Very good. Very happy to be here doing this first time interview slash pod. Excited to go with it.
Like you talked about there, Liam, it's the first time ever we've had guests on, and I'm actually delighted to say that we've got Thomas and Jack from the upcoming film Kate and Jack on the podcast today. Boys, welcome. Welcome. How are you doing?
Doing good.
Good man, yeah. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, honoured. First guest. Oh my God, get in.
Yeah, it'll go down in the annuals of history, like when we all make it big and famous, people remember this day.
This will be a landmark episode. I'm proud.
Fingers crossed, boys. So if you probably saw the title, and we're covering Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind later, but first of all, I just want to shout out that these fellas, like I said, are making their own feature film, the first feature film. They're a bunch of young filmmakers. Normally we start with a few opening questions, but this time I'm just going to let you boys run with it. So if one of you would like to tell the audience a little bit about yourselves, who you are, what you do, why you love film, stuff like that.
Yeah, sure. So my name's Jack McLaughlin, and I'm the writer and director of K&J. So why I love film? That's a tough one. I think it's because I've always had an interest in it, like creatively anyway. So like I was born in 1998. So when I was a kid, I'd always go to the pictures to see, like, because it was like the blockbuster era that came out then. Do you know what I mean? So it was like the prequels came out, the Star Wars films. And, you know, looking back in hindsight, that's got a very mixed judge, hasn't it? But as a kid, it was like going to see it and stuff and buy the toys and that. And then I remember like Sam Raimi's Spider-Man came out, and that was massive. So I'd always had an interest in it when I was a kid, and like growing up and stuff, like I was never really into football and all that like all the other kids were. I was more just like, I just want to go home and watch Toon Army. Don't know if any of you remember that on Cartoon Network, but that's what I mean. So I grew up with it around me a lot, you know what I mean? So it was like, I think like during that late 90s, early 2000s, there was just like a boom of pop culture. So like, and I was like born into that. But then I think I started taking filmmaking really seriously. I was about 12, and I watched Slumdog Millionaire, and it just blew my mind, because I'd never seen a film like that before. How it told this boy's life throughout the ages and that. And I was like, wow, that was amazing. And then it came up at the end, it said, you know, directed by Danny Boyle. And that name rang a bell. So I said to my dad, I said, that Danny Boyle, who is he? And my dad was like, he's a director, he makes films, and he won the Oscar for Slumdog Millionaire. So I googled him, and like my head fell off, because I realised he's only from Radcliffe, which is in Greater Manchester. And I was like, it's literally down the road from where I'm from. And it's like, and he made a film and won an Oscar. So it became achievable then to like become a director. Do you know what I mean? Because honest to God, I thought it was only certain Americans do. Do you know what I mean? Because those are the films that I was brought up on. And I thought, oh yeah, it's only Americans that do that. But now, like seeing like Danny Boyle do it, that was like, okay, this is what I want to do now. I want to be a director. Now then, like when I figured out what it was, so that's why, yeah, I think that's where like my love of film properly started, was with that film. And then from then on, it's just, as you know yourself, you just go on a journey of film from then. You Completely. Know, you look at the filmmakers that inspired Danny Boyle, and then you look at the filmmakers that inspired them. And yeah, that's just kind of where it started, really. Like, that was the first kind of spark, but it was always there since I was a kid, I'd say, definitely.
Yeah. I love that, man. I love that. I think most people, I think we've spoke about it on a podcast before, Liam, that like, when it comes to film and getting into film, it starts off with one filmmaker, and then you just go, and once you exhaust all their stuff, you go mad, pick up all the other stuff that inspired them. So onto yourself then, Thomas, mate, why film? What films?
It's kind of weird how similar mine and Jack's answers are going to be, because I was literally going to say that probably my earliest like love for film, or the signs of love for film, actually did start with the Star Wars prequels Sam Raimi's Spider-Man trilogy.
Yeah.
And then obviously like with the Star Wars prequels, you get into them as a kid, and you obviously return to like the original trilogy. And don't get me wrong, I know like they're not all masterpieces, but I was Star Wars and like Marvel mad back when I was a kid. And then like them videotapes just like got rinsed. They got played over and over again until like they hardly worked. And like, well, my brother, he's autistic, and he basically just hoards VHS tapes and DVDs. And I couldn't ever really make it out to cinema, so I couldn't really go and watch like new films. And I'd just spend my days literally going through my brother's videotapes and DVDs and just watching like all sorts of different films. Which was kind of nuts. Like I'm kind of jealous now. I wish I had that myself, like my own Criterion closet, just like walking in. And anyway, like those types of films like fueled my imagination as a child. So I'd be writing like comic strips, or you know, photography, or writing my own short stories and all that. And then eventually, like it wasn't until I was about 15 or 16, I finally watched Goodfellas by Martin Scorsese, and that was, I think, that was like Slumdog Millionaire was for Jack in a way. That was the film that kind of like lit up my head, and my head proceeded to fall off and my body, I was just like, what did I just watch? That was amazing. And that kind of like opened my eyes to how much of an art form film could be. And then with the exact same thing of, oh right, there's that director, mine was Scorsese. I was like, right, I want to watch everything Scorsese's ever made. And then, as you guys might know if you've watched his interviews, he's like a film archive machine. And he just reels off all these classics. So then I'm noting down every film that Scorsese's recommending to watch. And then you're kind of getting a history like of film like from that then. And then you find more directors and more favorites. And yeah, that's how mine started anyway.
That's I love this, you know, because I feel like we're all pretty much the same, where we might have picked a different film that started it all, but when you, or well, maybe that kind of started the real film lover, the craziness that we all have, but it all goes back to like the really bad Star Wars films that we all grew up on. We're all around the same age, so completely. Just a couple little quick questions you can rattle through. Like, if you had to pick a favorite movie, I'm going to come to you, Jack. What are you going to say? What would you pick?
Yeah, I'd say like my top favorite film. Well, one of them is like Godfather Part 2. And whenever I say that, people go, well, why not Part 1? And my Part 1's great, and it is a classic. But Part 2 is just, I don't know, I remember watching it for the first time properly all the way through, and again it was like a similar experience to Slumdog Millionaire. It was just the epicness of it and the way it went back and forth in time, and it was so clever. Just everything, like the story of it, about like, you know, Vito's immigration from Italy to New York, and because the thing was, like, we've seen Godfather 1, so we've seen what he become. You know, we saw the end results with Brando and that, and then it was his journey from a child to obviously being Rob De Niro and that. But then contrast that with Al Pacino as Michael. And I think, like, honestly, like, Al Pacino's performance in that film, like, he should have won the Oscar for that.
It's insane, isn't it?
He's like, it's crazy. It's just like his whole arc in the film from like the end of the first one. It's just like what he does in Part 2. I don't know whether I can spoil it. Can I spoil it? Or
you can spoil it. Like, it was the first film we ever. Yeah.
40 years. You know what I mean?
Spoiler ban's been lifted, I think.
Definitely.
But like when he like, you know, basically sets up for Fredo to be killed. Like, that's his brother, and it's just the whole like the kiss of death and the party. I just love it. Like, that is a flawless film to me. I just love it.
The interesting trivia fact as well about that film, well, about the character Vito, there's only two characters ever that have had two different actors win a best actor Oscar for playing the same character. One is Vito Corleone, and the other one, I don't know if you can guess who the other one is, the other character. Can you
is
guess
it
who
Robert
it is?
De Niro related?
No. Well, maybe very, very loosely. Very loosely. I'll just tell you, it's the Joker. So the Joker and Vito Corleone are the only character that have two different actors win Oscars for playing them, which I thought was really cool.
I quite enjoyed that.
It's just a bit weird that the Joker is. Yeah, I know. Well, I am here to pop up with some facts every now and then.
I like that.
I love a cheeky bit of trivia. To be fair.
So I've got two more questions on my little agenda here, and I'm going to come to yourself, Thomas, because I can almost figure out what your answer to the other question would have been.
Yeah, it literally was that one as well.
Yeah. If you had to pick the greatest film ever made, it all comes down to you, mate. You've got to tell us. What would you pick?
Well, so like you guys kind of touched upon the greatest film ever, like that subject in your last pod, didn't you, with Citizen Kane. But I was thinking about this earlier, and I've got three films down as, so first one's actually the first Godfather film, because I think that is an absolute stone cold masterpiece.
Oh yeah, completely.
Second choice would be Akira Kurosawa's Seven Samurai. It's just monumental.
Mm-hmm.
Or a third one, which I think is arguably better than both of them, is Kurosawa's High and Low, which it's such an amazing film. I think it doesn't get anywhere near as enough recognition as it should for being like, it is amazing. Like, I think it might be Kurosawa's best film, to be honest. And from my personal opinion, I think that could possibly be the greatest film ever made.
I've never seen any Kurosawa films.
Change that.
Yeah.
Change that when you get a chance, man.
We could do it on the pod sometime, I'm sure.
I'd be into that. All right, and then my little last question then. It seems quite relevant, actually, that I'm asking yourself this, Jack. Who inspires you? What filmmaker makes you want to make films nowadays? It might have been Danny Boyle in the old, back when you were a kid, but nowadays, who inspires you the most?
I don't know if I could pin it to one director. There's a whole bunch, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So like, just to rattle names off, is like Scorsese, obviously, just because of how he started and stuff and what he's done. You know, Scorsese, I think, you know what I mean? Yeah. So another one's like Paul Thomas Anderson. There's a guy called Edward Yang, and he's a late great Taiwanese director. Mm-hmm. I love his stuff. Lynn Ramsey, big up Lynn. Love Lynn Ramsey.
Big up Lynn.
Definitely. Steve McQueen, he's one that's inspired me at the minute, just because what he's doing with Small Axe. His anthology of five films, which I was telling you about that somewhere, and I was like, I cannot believe, they literally are five films he's just banged out. It's just like, that's as just insane.
Yeah.
He literally. It's like Steve McQueen, Lynn Ramsey, and that. Andrea Arnold as well. I love her stuff. So those are the kind of guys that really inspire me.
I love how diverse it is as well.
Another one. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I absolutely love that.
I had such a list for that.
I'm sure. Yeah, I thought. I think Tom, me and you followed each other on Twitter for quite a while. So anytime a Scorsese tweet comes up, it's normally one of us will have retweeted it, and then one of us will retweet the other ones. That's how it works. So I thought it might have been a Scorsese shout from yourself there, but
it was one of five. I had five directors pop to mind. I had Scorsese for his use of music and the use of his camera movement to convey meaning. I think. Mm-hmm. That was just a given. Hitchcock's craft of suspense. And I love how he moves the camera in accordance to, what the audience should be looking at. I think that's amazing. Kurosawa's blocking and composition of his actors to tell story visually. That is amazing. That's unrivaled, in my opinion. Although Hitchcock's Rope is really good for blocking as well. And then Denis Villeneuve. I don't know if I've pronounced his name right, but everything I watch of him, he just knocks out the park. And I'm just like, I don't know. I can't put my finger on what it is with him that kind of inspires me creatively, but.
Yeah. I have a quick question as well. It's kind of, I know we want to move on to your films as well, but just quickly, I want to know kind of what is your, who's your favourite director who uses kind of soundtrack the best? Because I've been listening to I've been listening to the Pulp Fiction soundtrack a lot recently. Yeah. And I think Tarantino is probably almost unrivaled, maybe up there with Scorsese as kind of the best at, you know, choosing their soundtracks for their films. Just wondering, you guys, what's your opinion on that? Who's your favourite?
I'd literally agree with you there, Liam. I'd literally say Tarantino and Scorsese were my top two. Like, they all popped into mind. I think they're amazing at their choice of soundtrack. It's like a character on itself when you think of a film. Like, their soundtracks are literally their own sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
I feel like as well, like with Tarantino and Scorsese, like, that's just, it's one of their staples as well. Do you know what I mean? And kind of, they do it so well, and it's kind of like, when anyone else tries it, it's almost like an imitation, and they never pull it off as well as Scorsese and Tarantino do. Mm-hmm. The only other director that comes to mind who pulled it off quite well was like Paul Thomas Anderson in Boogie Nights, but that's because it was like 70s and there was so much great music anyway. Mm-hmm. But like, yeah, definitely I agree with Tom about that though, that Scorsese and Tarantino just consistently great soundtracks in their work.
I think that's such a good shout, you know. When as soon as you asked that, Liam, I was trying to write in my brain about who I could think of. The only guy that came to my mind was, nowadays anyway, I know he's only made two films, but Jordan Peele so far. I want to know what his Spotify playlist is, because all the tunes on there are heavy. I love all of them.
I think he shares his Spotify playlist on Twitter every now and then.
Really? Edgar Wright does the same, actually.
Edgar Wright, Edgar Wright definitely does.
Oh, Edgar Wright, yeah.
Yeah,
I know. I think we asked this question. Oh, sorry for cutting you off there, Tom.
No, it's okay. I'm just chatting to myself.
I think we asked this question once before, or like way back when on the podcast, and I'm sure I remember saying that one of my favorite soundtracks is the Black Panther soundtrack. And like thinking back, I don't know what your guys' opinion is on Marvel. I think one of you said that you're a Marvel fanboy a little bit. I definitely am, and I think like Kendrick Lamar's soundtrack to Black Panther is one of the best of, you know, of recent times, especially in terms of, you know, something so kind of vast, and you know, it's a superhero film, yet it's got such a kind of boss soundtrack. Sorry, that just came to my head. I just wanted to add one final little piece of soundtrack that I love.
I can't actually remember it, you know, because I have seen Black Panther and I did enjoy it, but I have only watched it once and I can't remember the soundtrack. So I might have to revisit that after this podcast.
It's pretty good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So obviously we're here to talk about you guys and your film, Kate and Jack. And would one of you please like to just give a little, I don't know, maybe a little synopsis, tell us a little bit about it and your inspiration behind it? I know off air, Jack, you kind of touched on some advice you were given, if you wouldn't mind sharing that.
Well, Kate and Jake, it's about the next couple who meet up one last time before one of them takes a job opportunity in Australia. And after they meet up, the film goes back and forth in time to show you what happens in their relationship and basically how they ended up where they are now. So yeah, the idea of the film basically came in my last year of university. And I was always thinking, like, what's my first feature going to be? You know, watching loads of interviews by my favourite directors talking about their films. And funny enough, like, going back to Scorsese, you know, I remember when he and Bong Joon-ho said it at the Oscars, where it's like, make it personal. Like, personal is always best. Do you know what I mean? So I was like, okay, then I'll do that. So I looked at myself and my friends, and the biggest thing that was happening in our lives at the minute was relationships. And I always remember another specific advice was like, what's happening around you. So that was the biggest thing. So it was kind of people who had been in very long relationships, like 6 years, they were breaking up. And bear in mind, they've been together through like school, college. So like a really important development stage of their life. And then all of a sudden they were split off. And I remember a friend of mine, they were really gutted, because they've been together with the partner for about 6 years. And I remember they said to me, it just feels weird because I've never known a life where this person hasn't been in it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wow, that's like that's so deep and depressing, and it's mad, and it's heartbreaking as well, do you know what I mean? And I was like, my in early, and I was going through like a really rough patch with a girl at the time. So all this kind of sadness really just like flooded the script. And I think I'd done the first draft in about 2 weeks, I think it must have been. Because it was just it was just all pouring out. Do you know what I mean? It was like all this like anger and sadness, it just went right into the script. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, so that's where it all came from. And then I think I sent Tom, I don't think it was the first draft, it may have been the second, but
I think, yeah.
Yeah, but then that's when Tom came on board from there, yeah.
I love that, guys. I love that. I love that some things like this start in uni, because like you said, I don't know if you said it on air or off air, but that's how you guys kind of met. It must be a bit mad though, writing and trying to create a film in the middle of this whole pandemic and all the nonsense that's surrounding it. So at the minute, you guys are still in pre-production, is that right? You've been in the rehearsal stage at the minute or something like that, yeah?
Yeah.
How's COVID and coronavirus and all this madness kind of affected pre-production of a film, especially your first feature film? That's insane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everything.
I can imagine.
Everything is affected in some way or another.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like, even like trying to raise funding, it's like we're in the middle of a health and economic pandemic with Christmas on the horizon. So that's hard. And then casting, like me and Jack have been producing this film, and since we started producing the film, we haven't been able to meet up once in person.
That's insane. Yeah.
As I'm like set up in Wales and I haven't been able to cross the border.
Mm-hmm.
What else, Jack? It's just everything, isn't it?
Everything you can imagine. Is
difficult because obviously you're under threat of you're under threat of fines, and obviously people are vulnerable. Like, people don't want to catch COVID-19. Yeah. I don't think anyone's.
Have you been able to do any of that over Zoom at all?
Yeah.
Yeah, we've had to just find, like, it's literally just a case of adapting. Yeah, and Zoom has been so helpful, to be fair. And it's just like, I think rehearsals have gone well though, haven't they, Jack? And everything's going smoothly.
Yeah,
It's just a weird case of having to constantly keep up with the changing times, I guess.
I think it's super inspired. Like, fucking hell, we struggle to run a podcast during lockdown, and we only see each other maybe, like, even watching a film and talking about it once a week became a bit of an issue for us. So, like, trying to plan a film and you're still in pre-production, like you touched on, your crowdfunding, crowdsourcing at the minute.
Yeah.
And you guys are doing really, really well. I think some of us at First Date, we've shared it a couple of times, but if you want to drop in now and at the end of the podcast, where people can find you, because we are in full support of this.
Thank you very much. Honestly, it means a lot. Literally,
Much, guys.
People don't have always have money in their pockets, but even like just liking a post and sharing it can do so much, because it helps get the word out, doesn't it? So, yeah, you guys have been very supportive of the project, so we appreciate that a lot.
No, it's absolutely fine. We had probably the nicest message anyone's ever sent us a couple of days ago from a lovely fella called, I'm pronounced his name right. His name's Gabriel Pacheco. Probably not. You can DM me again and tell me I said it wrong. But he's a lovely fella from Brazil, and he reached out and sent a really lovely message and actually had a question for you guys.
Fab.
And he wants to know if there has been anything has been the biggest challenge for you so far, non-money related and non-COVID related, if there has been something.
Oh, non-money and non-COVID related.
Mm-hmm.
That's quite a difficult one, because mine was literally going to be what I just touched on then, and raising money in a pandemic.
Yeah.
So anything pops into your mind, Jack?
So because obviously me and Tom have done the production schedule, but even like with rehearsals as well, like just trying to get everyone in the same room, because a lot of the cast and crew work full time jobs and that. But yeah, I think that's the biggest thing, is just scheduling. And making sure everything's planned to a T as well. So, like, location recce's, tech scouts, that type of thing is... Tom, I don't know about you, but it is boring, isn't it? All the pre-production stuff, it's like you just want to...
Yeah.
You just want to... You get to a certain point where you're just like, I just want to go on set now and shoot the thing. Do you know what I mean? But it's all necessary, and you have to do it. Do you know what I mean? But I think scheduling can be really tough.
That's
twice now.
It's really hard, isn't it? It's really hard for us doing this over Zoom, trying not to interrupt each other. Anyway, I just wanted to follow on from Gabrielle's question and kind of ask you both, have you had or did you have issues finding your cast? Because obviously, Jack, you've wrote the film, and obviously, it's very obviously precious to you. It's kind of something very personal to you. So, did you kind of struggle finding the cast? You know, to bring your vision to life.
Do you want me to take that, Tom, or do you want to?
I'll just quickly say, and then you can chip
in. Go on, man.
I was just gonna say, like, the way we wanted to shoot it, I think it was the most important part was getting the right chemistry between the cast. Just because obviously this is a story that spans like quite a number of years. And you need to feel that there's actually a history there between them. And obviously with COVID as well, it's not like you can always meet up and get that relationship built before shooting as well. Mm-hmm. So we had to take many steps, and we went through quite a lot of really talented actors actually who auditioned to get the right people for the roles. I think we've hit gold with a cast as well, because I think the chemistry there is brilliant. And I'll let Jack elaborate on that because it makes more sense. So there you go, Jack. Take the floor.
Yeah, nice one. So yeah, it was like Tom said, we basically put out a casting call, like as you do, but obviously because of COVID, they had to be just all self-tapes, like we couldn't do in-person auditions. And we've seen some really, really great actors, we did, but they just didn't have the kind of the thing we were looking for, you know what I mean, for the characters of Kate and Jake, who we ended up casting Mikey as Jake. So I'd worked with Mikey before, actually went to college with him. So he was studying musical theatre and I was studying film. And with Mikey, I'd done a short film with him called Cruising. And we got on really well like then. And then he was going into his final year of university and swapped from musical theatre to acting, like stage acting, screen acting, that type of thing. And I always remember he had a play on called Wojciech, and he was playing the lead in it for his final year show. And he was going, Jack, you've got to come see me in this play. I'm a much better actor now, you know what I mean? And I was like, you're a great actor anyway, you know what I mean? But so when and seeing him, and he was like incredible, do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So Mikey got in touch with me about the film, saying, can I audition? Can I send the self-tape? Because he's a friend of mine, I did say, you know, I can't just give you the role. Like, you're going to have to go through what everyone else goes through, do you know what I mean? Give him a fair chance and stuff. So me and Tom are just seeing, like, lot of self-tapes, and was like, wow, we can't find our Jake. And then Mikey sent the self-tape in, and within about 30 seconds it was just, I just knew he was going to be it, because he just has Mikey, he just has like that natural, he has like a natural charisma to him, do you know what I mean?
There's that spark
sorry Tom, not sad, but like the audition that he done, Tom put it on Facebook as like a reward for us hitting a certain target on the crowdfunding. Mm-hmm. And it was like, just like when you watch it, it's just, he just oozes that charisma, and it's like a coolness to him. And like, because Jake has that, but then he also has a vulnerability. Mm-hmm. And Mikey, if you see him, he's got like, you won't mind me saying it, like, because I know him well, but and he'll admit it, he has a tough exterior, do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Whenever he gets cast in the film, it's always as like Scally or a drug dealer or an hard knock, do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, that he's got charisma, great. And then I said, I need to see you do vulnerable. So he done one of the scenes in the film, and like, Tom, what was he like? He was incredible.
He was brilliant.
So like that. Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Sorry, man. Yeah. No, go on, Tom. So like, and then with Sarah, who's playing Kate, we did have an actress, but it didn't work out. But no, we won't go into that. But so we needed to kind of like recast, basically. And Anthony, who's playing Ian in the film, Jake's brother, was like, I know this girl called Sarah who. Mm-hmm. In his class, I think, in uni. I'm not too sure, but they knew each other anyway, and Sarah studied acting as well. But yeah, bear in mind, Anthony, Sarah, and Mikey had all been in the same university, Liverpool Media Academy.
Oh, wow, okay.
So, and again, like, the same thing with Mikey. She sent in a self-tape and was, like, incredible. Do you know what I mean? And I was like, wow. And then we'd done a screen test with her and Mikey. And I didn't know it at the time, but Sarah and Mikey actually were like really, really good friends and had actually played a couple on stage before.
Wow.
So when we watched them in the screen test, it was just like, that's it. Like the chemistry's there. And they're really fearless with the roles because it's really tough roles what they're doing. And they're just not scared to go there. They just go for it. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And like what I'll end on is, it's funny because so Sarah, who's playing Kate,
mm-hmm.
literally lives down the road from me. Like she lives at the bottom.
It's crazy.
She lives
isn't
at the bottom. Honestly, man, she lives at the bottom of my street. So I always like what the biggest thing I learned from the casting is, you know, you think you have to go far and wide to find the perfect people, when in reality they are, in this case, literally on your doorstep. Do you know what I mean?
It's, oh man, that's awesome.
So it was crazy how it all worked out, like the casting. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we're very fortunate, like Tom said, to have them, and the chemistry that they've got is incredible. Because awesome. Because me and Tom said early on, like that's what the film lives and dies on, is the chemistry between them. Yeah. Do you know what
mm-hmm.
I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And they got it. So
it's a character piece as well, really, isn't it? Like it's quite an intimate like portrait of these two people. Mm-hmm. So if you cast them two people wrong, like it doesn't matter how well the project, like the production goes, it's not gonna have the magic.
You know what? Honestly, I absolutely loved that. And then maybe not so recently, but it was reshared anyway that maybe both of you guys have given your actors like a list of films to watch. And I fucking love when people do that because I think it's so cool. Yeah. And I was going through some of them and I was like, oh, you know what? I've not seen like four or five of these. I think you listed off like Blue Valentine, which is one I genuinely have seen. It's awesome. The Four trilogy was on there. It's something I'm slowly working through, but it hits me so much, man. They're emotional films. And then I always wanted to watch Eternal Sunshine. I've always wanted to watch it. And then I thought, oh, this might be a nice little overlap for us to talk about this film, how it relates to your guys, the film that you guys want to make. And also, I can grow up a little bit and finally watch a film that sounds really good. So we'll just do like a little impromptu first take, because I think it's my first take out of everyone. You boys have all saw it before. And it normally doesn't work that way, that when it's someone's first take, they host. But you know what? So I'll just give a little brief synopsis of the film and then we can start chatting about it.
Okay.
So after a rough breakup, Clementine undergoes a procedure to erase the memories of her former boyfriend, Joel. After finding out about this, Joel undergoes the same procedure, and then the film follows the journey through the slowly fading memories of their relationship. And I've said before in the podcast that normally any film at all can have a small little emotional scene and I will cry like a baby. And I'm sure we'll talk about it later on, but this film hit me like a fucking truck. Lads, if your film is anything like this, it might take me a couple of years to actually watch it, because fucking hell. You put it down as like the basis of a film that you want your actors to watch. And I guess, would you say that's kind of, did that help shape some of the chemistry, some of the dialogue between the two characters, how they're, I obviously don't want to spoil the film that you guys haven't even released or anything yet, but you know.
I think it's interesting, like when obviously I know the script and stuff of Kate and Jake, so I won't go into spoilers or anything, but
mm-hmm.
I think Eternal Sunshine tackles like two people who have their differences, you know, and like every relationship goes through its struggles, but I think Eternal Sunshine does a great job at almost like it's a reflection, it's a character's reflection on their own like toxic traits and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that looking back, isn't it, on fonder memories. And I'd say
don't spoil anything, please.
I'll let Jack lead the way, because he knows what I can say and what I can't. So go on, Jack.
Yeah, I think that was like, because I think why Eternal Sunshine was a big influence, like just on Kate and Jake alone, is because of like how it tells its story through time.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense.
Yeah,
I don't want to step on spoilers for Kate and Jake, but mm-hmm. time's a very big thing in both films, I would say.
Yeah.
Just to clarify, it's not like a Nolan flick.
No.
there isn't like a time paradox or anything. Thank God. Like,
no,
God. Yeah, right, just wanted to clear that up. I didn't want any.
We're not massive fans of Nolan on the first take, but
aren't you? That's fantastic. Neither of you, Jack. Grief.
Honestly, we should start our own thing. In fact, you know what, Chris, honestly, if you're listening, mate, you're all right. I just don't love Nolan.
Do you know what I seen the other day just about Nolan? And it really baffles me. As he said, like the directors would call him up because of how bad his audio mixing was, like his sound mix. And he actually says, I don't know if he actually said it, but I think he said something like he didn't realize like how important sound was. And I'm thinking, how the fuck do you not, like, do you know what I mean? Like,
I'm pretty sure that's like one of the first things that is hammered into you as a filmmaker. Yeah, it's literally you could film on a potato, but if you've got good sound, like the audience will still watch it. But the moment you have terrible sound, the audience are going to start clocking out. And I'm thinking, how is Christopher Nolan not, how is this not clicked in his head?
As someone who wrecked their own student film with terrible sound editing, I can attest to that.
It happens to the best of us.
Same.
It will get you from a first to a 2-1, put it that way.
It's so weird with Nolan as well, because like his sound design on the Dark Knight trilogy is actually, particularly The Dark Knight, is really, really fucking good. So for then for him to just kind of, I don't know what the hell he did with Tenet, surely you don't have to like go to a quieter cinema just so you can hear what's going on. Because I've seen it twice, and the first time I went to see it in IMAX, and it was like, no, I couldn't make out some of it. And I don't think it helps that the score kind of adds to this whole kind of distortion element that he was going for that doesn't quite work at all. But this isn't the Christopher Nolan slagging podcast. I'm sure we can do that another time.
Another time.
Honestly, it probably will happen another time. That's the best part, maybe over a pint. In a bite in 2025. Yes, that would be lovely.
Yeah, we're finally allowed to. Yeah.
But you know what's funny though? Like the connection between Nolan and Eternal Sunshine. I may be wrong, but I'm sure because I think Charlie Kaufman said he wrote it in like 1998. Mm-hmm. But Memento came out, and that was the big kind of. You know, going back in time type thing, non-linear. I think he just kind of, Charlie Kaufman, he's just like, it was just a slight subtle dig to Christopher Nolan, like a fuck you, you kind of, you know what I mean? We wanted to bring it out in 2000, you know what I mean? But I may be wrong, but I'm sure like Charlie Kaufman said that though about Memento.
I tell you what, it could have been a blessing in disguise though, because the cast is really good in the film.
Yeah.
I think they've got a really nice selection of cast. And
in Eternal Sunshine.
Yeah. And I think like if they brought it out 4 years earlier, you don't know how it could have turned out. It could have gone the complete opposite way, couldn't it? So
you wouldn't have had Kate Winslet. Definitely.
No, probably not. And she's amazing in that film.
She steals it for me.
So good, yeah. That's such a complex role to play, I think, and she absolutely smashes out of the park.
Mm-hmm. I just want to touch on this. Like I said, it was actually my first take. I'd never saw this film before, and I didn't have any clue what the hell was happening. Like, I didn't know much about it. I've saw like the occasional scene and the occasional like film theory about her hair being posted on film Twitter, because you know we're all on that. But like, I didn't know how the narrative progressed, and finding out that it was told in kind of almost non-linear, well, actually almost linear, but in a really reversed way. And it all is kind of cyclical. And I think that's why it really stood out for me, because we'll get on to the end and hopefully in a minute, but like, you can almost read it in two ways. It can be positive, it can be negative, it can be optimistic or pessimistic. And that's what absolutely floored me. And, man, I know Michel Gondry hasn't gone on to do the best work in the world, but if this is his film that he can hold up at the end of his career and say, yeah, look, I directed this, me and Charlie Kaufman wrote it, fucking well in, man, because I suppose there's a reason why everyone raves about it. There genuinely is, and it wrecked me completely.
The narrative structure is so weird, though. I was thinking about this earlier, and it's like, it is non-linear, technically, but it's also linear because the characters are involved with the viewer going back and so it is technical. Oh, I don't know. It gives me an absolute headache. Mm. But yeah, the structure of it is super complex, but they pull it off perfectly. Like, if I had to direct a film with that structure, I'd get lost. I honestly wouldn't have a clue where to start. So
would I.
It's funny, isn't it? Like, the only character from if you take the first sequence, well, the kind of opening like 10, 15 minutes, the only character that actually knows what's going on is Elijah Wood's character, as he knocks on the car window. Yeah. And like, that's the only kind of, so like when you're talking about like the narrative in terms of linear, non-linear, I guess he is that point of reference that actually he's the only one who knows out of the audience and out of the characters involved that really knows what's going on. And he is a bad, bad dickhead in this film.
Oh yeah.
Stealing her knickers and taking all of her belongings. Yeah. It was next level creepy. Mm-hmm. To be honest, I love this film. I watched it once before, maybe a couple of years ago, and I've just watched it now, maybe, I don't know, about lunchtime, and I've actually bought it this time so I can go back and watch it again. And it's just a brilliant film. It's just great.
Yeah.
I do like Charlie Kaufman. I think my favorite of his is probably Being John Malkovich. I think that personally is his masterpiece, in my opinion. I think his relationship with Spike Jonze is, I think it's amazing.
Yeah.
Like their collaboration, their styles, because they're kind of different styles. His writing is a little bit different to his directorial style. So then when you bring them together, it kind of just works. That's why I love that. It's like my favorite Kaufman film for sure. But I think you can't watch this film without kind of taking into account that it is him writing it, because his style is quite similar throughout most of his films. He often has like a protagonist who is almost like him. He does often write him with himself in mind when he's writing his protagonists. And I don't know, sometimes I think once you know that, it maybe sometimes it can become a little bit boring in a way. Like when I don't know if you boys have watched I'm Thinking of Ending Things, his obviously latest film that came out this year on Netflix. And he uses Jesse Plemons as kind of, I guess, the protagonist, who is also mirroring a type of Kaufman character. Mm-hmm. And I mean, even like take Adaptation as well. Like he literally has, you know, Nick Cage play him, like he's literally called Charlie Kaufman.
Yeah.
Like, I think he is a little bit self-indulgent at times, but I think when it works, it does really work. Like in this film, I think it does pay off massively. I just kind of wanted to go, I know this is about you boys and your opinions on kind of this film and obviously your new film that's coming out, but we'll go to Connor quickly because it is your first take, and obviously that we'll stick to it just a little bit. Just quickly give us your first take when the film finished. What were your thoughts?
You know what? So when I go home, like I'm from Ireland, when I go home for Christmas and stuff like this, or it's probably just Christmas at the minute because of all the nonsense that's going on, I'll get the ferry because it's so much cheaper, but it's like an 8-hour journey. And I'll always buy or download a couple films on my laptop to watch. And this is the only film I've bought and I've never watched it because I've been too scared. Like I said, films really affect me. And I don't know what it is, but watching films about relationships going wrong, I'm just not into it. And I've always wanted to watch this film. And as soon as I knew that it was coming, I prepared myself. Like, I had a couple drinks last night. I was feeling a bit rough. And about maybe 45 minutes in, I already felt the tears. And then by the end, I fully sobbed like a child watching it, but in the best way, because personally I view it as quite a optimistic film at the end. It's quite a romantic film. I think it says a lot of good things about, is it better to have loved and then lost and then loved again? And I tend to agree with that. And I don't know, man, overall, I think it's the only Kaufman I hadn't seen up until now. And now that I've watched it, I can't really argue with him as maybe one of the best writers we've ever really seen. For me,
I always think sorry to interrupt, but I always think, like, nowadays especially, a genius gets thrown around left, right and center.
Mm-hmm.
But like, personally, I think like Charlie Kaufman, he is a genius. Like, what he's done throughout his career, even with like Synecdoche, New York. Have you guys seen that?
Synecdoche, New York? I haven't. So I know we spoiled The Godfather Part 2, but if you can't, if you can avoid spoiling
it. No, don't worry. But I remember like watching that for the first time, and that just like, like you kind of with this film, it rocked me. I was like, I need to like sit down and like think about things, you know what I mean?
Take stock of everything.
I was just kind of like, oh yeah, that's me writ off for the rest of the night. Do you know what I mean? But yeah, definitely.
One thing that really did stand out to me though was, I wrote it in the agenda, I called it like visual literacy. Like this might actually be more on the direction from Michel Gondry and the cinematographer's name I've written down, but I cannot remember her name and I feel awful now. Like you talked about Scorsese, Tom, earlier, how he kind of uses camera movement to denote like thematic issues or narrative progression and stuff. The camera work and the editing together in this is honestly astonishing. Like you know what's going on, even though you might not follow the narrative, you can follow the emotions that Joel or Clementine at the time are feeling. And I don't know, like there is that quote that cinema is the great empathy machine or something like that. And this film exemplifies that for me. I've not been in that situation. I never had my mind wiped and have forgotten everything, but I have thought about the importance of memories with people that are no longer with me, or girlfriends I'm no longer with, or people that I don't talk to anymore, stuff like that. And like I said, his ability to kind of, or their ability, the collective ability to not just explain tone and narrative, but you can almost get the texture of the film by watching it. It probably is probably the best film I've watched, and I've watched Citizen Kane a lot recently, the best film I've watched in a couple months. It's unbelievable. It really, really is.
Bloody hell, that's a review, isn't it?
I did watch Citizen Kane a lot though, to be honest, so maybe I got a bit sick of it. No harm to Orson Welles, he's not listening, is he? But you know what I mean, if the estate of Orson Welles are listening.
I mean, go on.
We keep doing this, Tom. We keep doing this. I just wanted to talk about one of my favourite things in this film, and it is the transitions and how they are literally involved in the storytelling. Mm-hmm. I think I've not seen it done this well. I mean, maybe I have, but not. I can't think off the top of my head it being done so well as in this film. It's just incredible, and it probably does help obviously with the fact that it's kind of dream sequences that they're going in and out, transitioning between, so it kind of, you can play around with it a bit more. But kind of, you know, with, there's a scene when they're sat on the sofa and it kind of starts raining in the living room, and then it's like that, how that transitions to the next kind of scene. It is brilliant. Like, it is visually brilliant. It kind of starts out, you know, I guess you kind of aren't expecting it in a way to be so visually like beautiful, because it kind of doesn't almost start that way. It does start almost plain. You know, you can't actually see that's about, like, that's coming, if you don't know obviously that all these dream sequences are going to be happening. So I think obviously with that almost surprise of all of these kind of brilliant sequences, I think it kind of adds the effect. You know, it makes me seem even better. It is technically brilliant as well, to be fair, as well as the writing, the direction. It's just everything's just kind of spot on with this film, I think. But I just wanted to touch on another thing in terms of the story. And obviously with Connor, you saying that, you know, you had a little bit of a cry when you were watching it. But I think it's one of those things, isn't it, where I think kind of the things that you've experienced in your life and how they affect your viewing of a film. Because like, I've never, you know, experienced breakup. I've been with my girlfriend for 5 years. So like watching something like that, I don't kind of put myself in their shoes in a way, maybe the way that like Connor, you do. I don't know you boys personally, if you've been through things like that, but it's definitely kind of interesting, isn't it, how we personally experience films depending on, you know, what has happened in our lives.
Completely.
Yeah, I was like that with Blue Valentine, you know. Like, first time I watched Blue Valentine, like, Connor hit me like a fucking tree. And I couldn't revisit it for like a year or two afterwards. Like, I literally couldn't revisit it. but I instantly put it in like my top five favorite films of all time, Blue Valentine, because I was just, it just hit me like at the right point in my life. Mm-hmm. Like you said, Liam, it's your own personal experiences and how they are affected by a film, and it was just all added up. And that's what Blue Valentine did to me, which this film can do to others.
I fully get that. In fact, Blue Valentine was on that list that we talked about earlier. I want to know, though, if this isn't a genre that I normally go for, and I'm not going to, it's not a rom-com by any means, but it's a romantic film. It's a story about love and relationships and how they kind of progress or maybe dissipate. Some of the films that you talked about on that list and others that are, you know, that aren't on there, I don't know if I can think of a film that portrays like everything, all the little minutiae of a relationship as well as this. We did talk about the Before trilogy. I've only saw the first two installments of those. The first one for me is my favorite, like it just the romance of all I love. But I don't know how it progresses in the final third or whatever. So I can't exactly equate it to that, but it's probably the closest I've saw. This seems like a completely new take. I know 2004, it wasn't new, but in the grand scheme of things, cinema's quite a young art form, so I'm not sure if we can compare it that highly. Like, but I just want to know, have you guys ever saw a film that has, I don't know, maybe depicted like love and relationships in a similar way, or maybe a way that's as interesting, if you can think of one off the top of your head? Except for Kit and Jack, obviously.
When
it was like, yeah.
It's on the list as well, but Bergman's Scenes from a Marriage. It's really good. It's like Eternal Sunshine in that way of like, even though it's a rocky relationship and all this, they're still kind of drawn to each other. Do you know what I mean? Because obviously in Eternal Sunshine, like that's the thing, is that even though Joel and Clementine, their memories are erased, they still have that connection. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I don't know whether it's the universe sending them a sign, but you know, there's just the fact that like when they meet at the train, like on the train, there's still that kind of instant thing there. And I know, like she said to him in the last memory before it collapses, like meet me in Montauk, but still though, just to kind of, because in that scene in the train, they don't know each other, but there's still that kind of connection there. Do you know what
completely,
I mean?
Completely.
Yeah.
Some of the things that stand out for me as well in this film are the kind of side characters and how the story doesn't take place in the, you know, the real material world. It kind of almost takes place in Joel's subconscious, and they kind of spill over and the real life also spills into his unconscious, and all this stuff is so uber Kaufman and so almost confusing, but it all makes sense once again because he is just that good. And some of the performances, like Kirsten Dunst in this film is Mary. Unbelievable. Young Mark Ruffalo as well. His hair might have been awful in that, and I'm one to talk, like, but my God, he's so good and he's so convincing. And you touched on it earlier as well, Liam. Elijah Wood's kind of snidey snakiness is, oh, it's so gross, but it almost is what helps the film. I don't know how to word this, but it almost helps the film kind of flip between genres, because on one hand, it is a romance film, but it's technically science fiction almost.
I was going to bring that up. It is weird thinking of it as a sci-fi film, but
it's like a precursor to Black Mirror almost. You know what I mean? Like, it's a better Black Mirror. I love Black Mirror, but you know, if Charlie Kaufman wrote it as well, I'd be way more into it. But the Patrick thing was crazy, and I couldn't really figure it out until that scene, well, that through line kind of collapses. And what the film does really well is these collapses of, it's almost like a domino effect where one story falls over, but it actually furthers the narrative. Whereas you see that Patrick has kind of been using the memories that Joel is trying to erase to form his own relationship with Clementine. That's some seedy stuff, man. I like Elijah Wood, definitely. But what a little shitbag he is in this.
It's so intrusive, isn't it? It's literally, you know, going into almost like her personal memory file and like almost like abusing that. Like he's taking advantage of his role, you know, his job. He's breaking that kind of trust that I guess Clementine put in the company that she approached to have this memory wipe. he's kind of just breaking all types of moral code going. And it's just, it's a little bit dark and twisted, isn't it? That whole element of what Patrick does, and he doesn't quite realize what he's doing, and he doesn't quite get his comeuppance either. Like, I know it's only a 1 hour 40 odd film, so you're not really, and it's not really about kind of revenge or anything like that. It would have just been nice to see him, I don't know, like get splashed by a, you know, like a moving car, like just get splashed by a puddle or something. But no, you know, that's another element of the writing. And it's so, the kind of the story, considering again that it is only so long, you know, so it is, you know, below 2 hours, and you still get, you know, this introduction to different characters and to these different dynamics, and you do get this different sides of people. You know, you get to see these different sides to Kirsten Stewart's character, and yeah, and it's interesting, you do get all these different dynamics as well with Kirsten Dunst's character Mary and Dr. Howard. That's another kind of almost cruel thing, in that he's having an affair with this young girl, and he says that that she has agreed to have her memory wiped to kind of forget about their affair, and so she can move on. You kind of stop and question that, you know, has she agreed to that? You know, did he maybe force her into something like that? And it is like really kind of, again, this the kind of intrusiveness and the kind of real kind of, it's almost quite gross in a way when you do properly think about how kind of it's your memories and how personal they are to you. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's kind of some of the moral things that Kaufman throws up, you know, with his kind of writing of this film. And I guess it does throw up a lot of kind of questions in that, would you want to forget about love? You know, would you want to, you know, just to kind of run away from that pain, or would you want to kind of deal with it and move on and, you know, almost let yourself grow? And I think that's really interesting when Joel, isn't it? It's Joel. Yeah, it is Joel. When he's having his memory wiped, and then he realizes that mid kind of dream or whatever, mid kind of memory wipe, that he's made a mistake, and he's running through his memories and kind of dragging Clementine along with him in his mind, trying to kind of clutch onto any kind of memory of her, so he doesn't want to forget her. And it's like, I guess that's kind of the difference, isn't it, between their characters as well, and that Clementine kind of just went through with it. You kind of get the impression that she just did it. It was quite impulsive, sporadic, and like that was that. Yeah, and whereas Joel was so desperate to not let go of her, so desperate that he was taking her to memories that they wouldn't find. Mm-hmm. And it's so clever. I do love the whole, and it's quite comedic at times as well, isn't it, with the whole when he's going into his childhood and he's playing like his baby. I don't know if you boys are kind of, I don't know what type of style you're going to do your film in. I don't know if you'd kind of, you've written some comedic elements in it. I know, like, kind of life in itself is quite funny anyway. So I guess kind of that natural humor does come into most art forms anyway. So yeah, it'd be really interesting to see, like, kind of if you take anything from that, from this film as well.
You touched on that. Sorry, just to jump in for a sec. You touched on that childhood scene. And for me, that is easily my favorite scene in the film, except for the ending, but that's kind of a cheat answer. We're going to wrap up soon, but I just want to know if you boys had to pick a favorite scene from the film, all three of you, obviously one at a time, please, hopefully. If you had to pick a favorite scene from the film, maybe a scene that means the most, a scene that you find funniest, maybe just the best, I don't know, portrayal of a certain character, please let us know. I'll start with you, Jack, if you don't mind a bit.
Yeah, like you, really, I think the best scene for me is the ending, because it's just a perfect ending. It's like it's so bittersweet, but you don't even, like, is it a happy ending, is it not? Are they just gonna make the same mistakes that they're gonna do again, but that, like, they're happy with it, but then even if they break up again, that the business is gone, so there's no, you can't get your memory erased anymore anyway. And it's just, I just love the way it ends, and like with Beck's song at the end as well, and there's, like, you know, that, like, just the last bit where they're on the beach and it's snow, and as it's fading to white, it keeps like going back like a few seconds, like it repeats itself a bit at the end. And I think like that's the whole, I don't know if it's the message of the film, obviously, but to me, like that's what I got from it, is that they are going to make the same mistakes really, and kind of, do you know what I mean? It's like life though, isn't it? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But like, that's what I mean. Like that is that the ending to me is just like one of the most perfect endings for any type of film. I think
it's almost like they want to make the mistakes, but then like they want to remember them this time.
Yeah,
like they know it's going to fuck up again, but they want to remember it this time and kind of grow from it and learn from it, rather than just, you know, completely wipe it out of their memory.
No, please go ahead.
I was going to say, I've always interpreted that as like it is literally a moment of acceptance, and like they've got the power of hindsight as well, which I think we all wish we had. And so they've literally got like a second chance at their relationship with hindsight to change themselves. So they kind of can reflect on themselves throughout the film, see what they both did wrong. So they, like you guys said, it is so open for interpretation of whether or not it's an optimistic or pessimistic ending. It's but I try and approach it as an optimistic ending. Even if it does come down in flames, they'll have the memories.
Yeah.
They'll still make the memories again. And I think it's lovely.
What's interesting, would any of you want to hear a video or like a tape, a recording of your other half saying all of your flaws, you know, spending 5 minutes talking about all of your flaws and then, you know, give it another go with that in mind? Would you really want that?
You know what? I'd probably be sat there going, yeah, she's got a point.
She's got a point there.
Yeah, I do that, don't I? Like, just... I'd probably be chipping in with ideas as well. Yeah. I'd be like, have you mentioned I do this? And
That's funny that.
That's what I loved about the ending as well. Like that bit when the messages are getting played, and it's like, because they don't even know what's going to be said. And it's like, it's Jim Kirby's like little smile of like, okay, maybe that was the worst of it. And then he just says something else that was worse than what he said before. And it's like, oh, fuck. You know what I mean? It's just like.
Completely.
But yeah.
Oh man, I honestly absolutely love this film. We'll wrap up now, but normally on the podcast we do this thing called popcorns. Popcorns is like, out of 100, how would you rate the film? It was my first take, but you guys are the guests, so I'll happily go first. It was the first watch for me. It hit me with all the fears I had going in were justified, but it wasn't like the film, the kind of emotional parts weren't done cheaply. It earns the right to make you cry and make you feel like shit at times, but it's catharsis for me and it's optimistic at the end. And I'd give it like an 85 popcorns, 85% for me. I'll come to you, Liam, and then we'll give the two boys a go as well.
Yeah, I'd go for a solid 80 popcorns. I do love the film. I just think it doesn't quite hit... because it's not as emotionally kind of affecting for me as probably it could be, but yeah, nonetheless, it's a brilliantly made film, so 80 popcorns for sure.
Yeah, I love the style of the whole film. I think the aesthetics are amazing, directing's amazing, Kate Winslet knocks out the park. It's really nice to see Jim Carrey turn in a more serious performance as well. I think he's quite underrated at doing that. And yeah, it hit me quite hard emotionally, and it seems to do it on rewatches as well. Seems to do it like to still hit. So I'm gonna give it 92.
Oh, I love that! Absolutely love
with
that.
With a high one.
Yeah, man. And for yourself, Jack, what are you saying?
You know what? I'm gonna give it the full 100. Like I literally love, like I love the film. Just everything, like Tom was saying, and like even Jim Carrey's performance in it, and Kate Winslet, they just knock it out the park, and the direction and the writing. Ellen Krauss, that's the name, that's the cinematographer's
name.
Yes. It, like the way she shoots it is incredible. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's just one of my favourite films, and I can't really find a fault with it. So yeah, it's just
perfect
film for me. Perfect. Yeah.
Awesome. Honestly, fellas, it's actually been so lovely having you on the podcast. Like I said, it's our first time having guests and having, you know, two young... Yeah. I'd say local, Liverpool uni graduates. I'm all about that. And honestly, best of luck with everything. You can find Tom and Jack or, hold on a sec. You can find Tom and Jack at Kate and Jack Film on Twitter. It's the homepage for their film that they're making. And you can also find the fundraiser in their bio, I think, as well. I've a link in the description or something like that.
Yeah.
Honestly, so thank you so much for joining us on this special episode of the podcast. If you've enjoyed and want to hear more stuff like this, let us know, because we're kind of looking to have some more guests, maybe bi-monthly. And boys, you're more than welcome to come on separately or as a duo, whenever you want. It's been a pleasure.
Anyway, we want to get you on when your film's made. That's what we want to do a first take of your film. That's what we want.
Oh my God, that'd be amazing.
That would
unless
be awesome.
You both hate it, and then it'll be
no, bro, don't worry. There's no,
if we hate it, we just won't ask you on. We won't tell you it's bad. We'll just not ask you on.
No way, man.
We'll record the episode and then we'll listen to it, and it'll just turn out you guys have recorded a separate episode. Just
honestly, it's been a pleasure, fellas. Until next time, thank you very much.